From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the CIA chief defends enhanced interrogation after the 9/11 attacks. A closer look at steps to control ISIL in Syria and Iraq.
These kinds of indirect steps are helpful, but they're not getting right to the root of the problem.
Chinese official says Taiwan relations are normal despite an election shakeup. And scientists get a closer look at an Egyptian mummy. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The chief of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency is defending its use of enhanced interrogation techniques in confronting suspected terrorists after the 2001 attacks against the United States. John Brennan disputed a lengthy U.S. Senate report this week that the harsh questioning tactics yielded no worthwhile intelligence and that they amounted to torture. He acknowledged that some CIA operatives went beyond authorized methods while they interrogated the suspected terrorists and said their actions rightly should be repudiated.
CIA officers' actions that did comport with the law and policy should neither be criticized nor conflated with the actions of the few who did not follow the guidance issued. At the same time, none of these lapses should be excused, downplayed, or denied. In some instances, we simply failed to live up the standards that we set for ourselves, that the American people expect of us.
In a Fox News interview, former U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney said the CIA did exactly what the White House wanted in setting up the interrogation program.
Partly what really bugs me as I watch all this process unfold is the men and women of the CIA did exactly what we wanted to have them do in terms of taking on this program. We said, we've got to go use enhanced techniques that we're going to find out. And we've got Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's the mastermind of 9/11, who has killed 3,000 Americans, taken down the World Trade Center, hit the Pentagon, would have taken out the White House or the Capitol building, if, in fact, they hadn't been for the passengers on United 93. He is in our possession. We know he's the architect. And what are we supposed to do? Kiss him on both cheeks and say, please, please, tell us what you know. Of course not. We did exactly what needed to be done in order to catch those who were guilty on 9/11 and to prevent a further attack. And we were successful on both parts.
Since the Senate report was released, countries the United States has often criticized for their human rights abuses, including China, are sharply attacking the CIA actions. In Beijing, Foreign Ministry spokesman Hong Lei said the United States has no right to pose itself as an arbiter of right and wrong. Russia and Pakistan joined in the criticism. Human rights activists are calling for the prosecution of officials involved in the CIA's use of extreme interrogation methods. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry chaired a ministerial meeting of the Global Coalition Against the Islamic State in Brussels, Belgium. The group agreed on a wide range of steps, hopefully to enable the coalition to weaken ISIL in Syria and Iraq and eventually defeat it. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy explored the impact of the agreed-upon steps on the strategy to counter the terrorist group with Michael O'Hanlon, Director of Research at the Brookings Institution.
Mr. O'Hanlon, 60 partners in the Global Coalition to Counter ISIL agreed in their meeting in Brussels to support military operations, stopping the flow of foreign terrorists and cutting ISIL's funding. How significant is that to the strategic plan to defeat the so-called Islamic State?
Well, I think it's important to see countries unify and also to take practical steps, such as the efforts to cut off funding and travel of would-be foreign fighters. But I also think that most of these measures are going to mitigate the problem. They're not going to end the problem by themselves. And we still have the reality that we need to see someone develop an adequate capability for combat on the ground in both Iraq and Syria. And in Iraq, that will ultimately be the Iraqi army, I believe. And in Syria, we don't yet know what it will be. But this kind of a coalition is very important, but it's not going to roll back what ISIS has already accomplished.
The meeting also welcomed the Iraqi government plan to defeat ISIL through a combination of security, political, and economic measures aiming at re-engaging all Iraqi communities in the democratic process. How crucial is that plan to mobilizing local populations to defend their territories from ISIL?
Well, there's no doubt that good faith efforts at better governance can help in Iraq, but I also believe there are fundamental and deep-rooted insecurities that different groups have towards each other, especially Sunni and Shia Arabs. And this is going to require a number of steps over the years, including perhaps even a long-lasting U.S. military presence of modest size to help these two communities gradually develop more trust in each other, because steps that are reversible for good governance are probably not by themselves going to repair the deep rifts. And those rifts, I think, are impeding the reconstruction of the Iraqi army and the development of a counteroffensive for going after ISIS.
Participants also commended the actions of the moderate Syrian opposition forces fighting against ISIL and called for increased support to these forces. Do you think the coalition provided the moderate Syrian opposition with what it needed in its fight on multiple fronts against ISIL and the Syrian regime?
Well, in broad terms, we're nowhere near doing what we need to do to help develop, protect, nurture, and grow a moderate Syrian opposition. The current policies are better than what we had a year ago, but they're not nearly adequate. And I don't mean that necessarily as a huge criticism. Some of this has to be step by step, but I think we need to get more ambitious, at least in our planning, about what would come next. And for example, we may need to contemplate a much larger Syrian opposition. We also may need to contemplate more direct military protection for that opposition in certain sanctuaries within Syria. And if we don't start thinking in those terms, I think we're probably not being realistic about what it's going to take to defeat ISIS and also perhaps to put pressure on President Assad in Syria.
Why would defeating ISIL take several years when it is encountered by such a powerful coalition of more than 60 nations?
Well, the coalition is not putting troops on the ground. And right now, ISIS rules a territory where it has the tyranny of and the monopoly of violence. And, you know, trying to weaken future flows of money and additional fighters, that's helpful for making sure the problem doesn't get worse. But it doesn't necessarily end the problem by itself. And it never has in the history of warfare. These kinds of indirect steps are helpful, but they're not getting right to the root of the problem.
Michael O'Hanlon, Director of Research at the Brookings Institution. After the collapse of Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations earlier this year and the devastating violence of this summer's Gaza war, tensions are understandably high between Israelis and Palestinians. Voices on both sides of the conflict question the United States' traditional role as shepherd of Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations. And Americans seem increasingly skeptical about their government's engagements in the Middle East. Brookings Institution's non-resident senior fellow, Shelby Tellamy, conducted a survey on American public attitudes toward the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that showed if the two-state solution collapsed, Americans prefer democracy and equal rights for all in one state. He also spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy.
Judging from your recent survey, how much importance do Americans attach to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and to reaching a solution?
Well, in general, you know, there's always a segment of the public that ranks this issue high in their priorities. We find, for example, that about 20% of the public say it's among the top three issues for them. This, of course, has to be compared with other issues. But what this allows us to do is to find out if there's a difference in the views of those who care a lot about the issue and those who don't care a lot about it. And as it turns out, this question, while it's important, focusing on those who care a lot about this issue, it turns out that there is another segment which cares a lot about human rights, even more than the Arab-Israeli issue. In fact, one quarter of Americans think it's the single most important issue for American foreign policy. And those people care a lot about the Arab-Israeli issue, and we find that they have a significantly different opinion from other segments of the population.
How do different communities in the United States, Democrats, Republicans, minorities, older Americans, vary in their attitudes toward Israelis and Palestinians?
Well, this is really the most fascinating question that we've been discovering of late. 20 years ago when I started doing research on this issue, you really didn't find significant differences between Democrats, Republicans, and independents. It was roughly the same. There were some differences, but they were not so pronounced. What you find now is like it's two different universes. I mean, you have, it's a huge difference between Democrats and independents on the one hand and Republicans on the other. For example, when you ask them whether they want the U.S. to lean to the Israelis, to lean toward the Palestinians, or to lean towards neither side. Among independents and Democrats, the overwhelming majority really wants the U.S. to lean toward neither side. And only a small percentage wants the U.S. to lean more toward Israel than the Palestinians. In the case of the Democrats, 17% want the U.S. to lean toward Israel, 6% toward the Palestinians. But among Republicans, it's completely different. You have a slight majority who want the U.S. to lean toward Israel specifically, not to be neutral on this issue. And much of that is really explained by the evangelicals in the group who tend to take this position almost as a sense of religious duty. We actually measure for that much more than a function of being an American interest.
Did the survey find any correlation between the American interest and the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and the rising threat of the Islamic State?
This is another interesting question. I know recently Secretary of State John Kerry was criticized by some people for suggesting that violence on the Israeli-Palestine question fuels support for ISIS. And we know that the American public finds ISIS as the biggest threat right now facing the United States. So it's fascinating that when we did the poll and asked whether people thought violence on the Israel-Palestine question fuels ISIS or whether it was completely independent from ISIS, we find that two-thirds of the American public and actually even 71% of Republicans thought that violence on the Israel-Palestine question actually is used by ISIS to rally support and to confront Israel and the United States more. So, yes, the public seems to see a linkage and seems to support the hypotheses that John Kerry put forth recently when he was criticized.
Shelby Talamy with the Brookings Institution. We plan on bringing you more of his remarks Monday on International Edition. China's top negotiator with Taiwan, a self-ruled island that Beijing claims as its own, is on a visit to keep relations upbeat, despite local election results last month. The visit by Chen Deming follows defeats in nine cities and country polls for Taiwan's ruling party, which backs strong economic relations with China after more than six decades of hostility. Ralph Jennings reports from Taipei.
Beijing's dedicated negotiator with Taiwan told local media this week relations will be unaffected by results of the November 29 elections. Analysts say the Nationalist Party lost three times as many seats as forecast that day, partly because of voter fatigue with its China policies. That showing may weaken the Nationalist government's mandate to extend 21 deals it has signed with China since 2008. Alexander Huang, strategic studies professor at Nanjiang University in Taiwan, says Chen's visit is meant to ease fears of a new decline in relations.
The function it serves is to prove to Taiwan people that no matter what election, that Taiwan's domestic political process is one thing. Cross-strait exchange is bigger than one election. I think that's the main thing.
Chen arrived in Taiwan Tuesday amid a light crowd of anti-China protesters, and a column of demonstrators also appeared outside a meeting venue in Taipei the next day. He later went to Taiwan's east coast to visit a local enterprise that is developing biotechnology and tourism. The negotiator is not expected to sign any new agreements with Taiwan, using the time instead to understand the island's business climate and assess what led to the ruling party's election losses. Ma Xiaozhang, spokesman for Taiwan's negotiator to China, tells VOA the negotiator wants to study local agriculture, biotechnology, and healthcare. Findings could lead to investment proposals from mainland Chinese firms, a boost to the island economy, and Beijing's hopes of eventual political unification. Taiwan's semi-official Central News Agency says Chen made a remark Wednesday that cross-strait relations would not change course because of the local elections. But the agency says he warned that a China-South Korea trade deal now in its final stages could take effect sooner than the 2 years as now expected. Taiwan and South Korea compete for markets as both economies are dominated by exports, largely to China. The Central News Agency adds that Chen urged Taiwanese lawmakers to ratify a service trade liberalization pact that the government signed with Beijing in mid-2013 or risk having it sent back to negotiators for a fresh look. In March, thousands of people occupied Parliament and surrounding streets in Taipei to oppose the Service Trade Pact and other links with Beijing. They fear China will use economic ties to push Taiwan toward political unification under Beijing's guidelines, an outcome that government surveys say 70% of Taiwanese people oppose. Taiwan's Defense Ministry spokesman said Tuesday the military wants to buy at least two military frigates from the United States. The U.S. Senate approved the sale of four frigates last week, following House approval of the sale in April. China opposes the sale, but Taiwan says it needs to defend itself as Beijing has not renounced use of force against it if needed. Taiwan President Ma Ying-jeou looks to agreements with China as support for the economy. Before he took office in 2008, the opposition Democratic Progressive Party angered Beijing with its pursuit of independence from China, making most agreements impossible. That party won seven seats in the November 29 elections. Ralph Jennings, VOA News, Taipei.
Ebola has revealed weaknesses in the healthcare system of Guinea, according to the country's health minister, Remy Lama. Lama spoke Thursday at a World Health Organization meeting in Geneva, aimed at finding innovative solutions to restore healthcare systems in the three countries worst hit by Ebola, Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. The epidemic is still spreading quickly in western Sierra Leone and deep in the interior of Guinea, according to the UN. The death toll from the Ebola outbreak in West Africa has risen to 6,331 in the three worst-hit countries, with Sierra Leone overtaking Liberia as the country with the highest number of cases. The UN Special Envoy on Ebola, David Nabarro, also spoke Thursday at the meeting in Geneva.
I think the people working on this response, thousands of people, people from the region, people from outside, really are amazing. Because they are putting their lives on the line. They are continuing the effort. Sometimes they just want to stay and go on because they feel they can't stop until the job is done. And so I'm delighted that yesterday Time magazine honored Ebola responders as Person of the Year. I'm saddened that so many of these good people have got ill, and I'm troubled that many of them have died, because I think that that really does show me and show you the risks that they are facing themselves because of their commitment to trying to help others.
David Nabarro is the UN Special Envoy on Ebola. Egyptologists at Chicago's Field Museum have opened the coffin of a 2,500-year-old Egyptian mummy to repair damage. The necessity of performing conservation work gives scholars a rare opportunity to see a mummy from the inside and to learn more about ancient Egyptian burial practices. Zlatika Hoke has the story for VOA Television.
The mummy's coffin was opened very carefully because the contents are extremely fragile.
People think mummies are kind of big and brutal and tough, but they're actually really, really fragile. So even a small quantity of inappropriate handling can do a great deal of damage.
Somebody stood the coffin up on one end, and the mummy's legs broke off at the knees. Then his feet broke off at the ankles and rotated sideways, causing the mummy to slide all the way down the coffin. Conservators will have to fix the burial mask and shroud and reconnect the detached feet. Then they'll have to shore up the mummy and the coffin so that they can withstand travel to Los Angeles for an exhibition next year.
He's a 14-year-old boy. We know from the coffin that his name was Minerdis. He was the son of Inaros, who was a fairly important priest of a god called Mene in central Egypt.
It is not clear why Minerdis died so young, but opening the coffin provides scientists with a rare opportunity to collect new information about the lifestyle in the later period of ancient Egypt's history.
The story that everybody knows about mummies is that they take your brain out through the nose, they take your organs out, they put them in canopic jars, and they put the jars with the mummy. What happens in this later period, and this is one of the more interesting things that one starts to learn, is that the organs were taken out, preserved, wrapped into packets, and then put back in either into the abdominal cavity or into the chest cavity or between the legs?
Under normal circumstances, scientists use a CT scan to look inside old Egyptian coffins. But there are some things CT scans don't show.
We found after we took the lid off that we could actually see some faint yellow outlines around the mummy, and we were wondering what it could be, because it looked like it was intentional. As soon as we took the mummy out, we found that it was actually a painting of the goddess Nut.
In ancient Egypt, Nut was the goddess of the sky. She was supposed to envelop the deceased and take him to the afterlife. Scientists say the discovery of the drawing was a complete surprise. Chicago's Field Museum acquired the mummy in 1920 from the Chicago Historical Society. It will be shown at a mummy exhibition in Los Angeles, scheduled to open next September. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On December 12, 1098, the starving armies of the First Crusade, on their way to capture the city of Jerusalem, attacked the western Syrian market town of Marat al-Numan. By some accounts, they massacred thousands of inhabitants and even resorted to cannibalism. On this day in 1745, one of America's founding fathers, John Jay, was born. Jay served as the first U.S. Chief Justice. Among his many contributions to the country, he served as ambassador to Spain and helped negotiate the treaty that ended the American Revolutionary War. On this day in 1901, Italian inventor Guglielmo Marconi said he received the first long-distance radio transmission. Marconi received the signals sent from England in St. John's, Newfoundland, about 3,500 kilometers away. In 1911, New Delhi replaced Calcutta as the capital of India. In 1915, Francis Albert Sinatra was born. The Grammy and Academy Award-winning singer-actor would become one of the most famous entertainment figures of the 20th century. On this day in 1985, Aero Flight 1285 crashed shortly after takeoff from Gander, Newfoundland, Canada. All 256 people on board died, including 248 U.S. soldiers. In 1991, the Maastricht Treaty was signed to create a European community. On December 12, 2000, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a set of opinions effectively halting a ballot recount in Florida and giving Texas Governor George W. Bush a razor-thin electoral victory there. This gave Mr. Bush the final victory over his opponent, Vice President Al Gore. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Alan Gross, an American development worker who was unfairly jailed for alleged crimes against the Cuban government, marks the beginning of his 6 year in prison there this month. Echoing requests from many foreign governments and leaders, the United States reiterates its call that Cuba releases Mr. Gross. Such an action, which is easily justified on humanitarian grounds, would remove an impediment to the deepening of more constructive relations between our government and Cuba. A Cuban court sentenced Mr. Gross to 15 years penal servitude for working to facilitate uncensored internet contact between a small religious community in the Caribbean island nation and the rest of the world. It is gravely disappointing, especially in light of the government's professed goal of providing Cubans with internet access, that the authorities have not allowed Mr. Gross to return to his family where he belongs. The United States has urged and will continue to urge the Cuban government to release Mr. Gross so he may return home.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.